Welcome to the Prisoners Justice Day edition of Groundwire Community Radio News, brought to you by volunteers at Canada's campus and community radio stations.
Groundwire is a project of the members of the National Campus and Community Radio Association.
This episode of Groundwire was produced on traditional territory of the Tsalo Nation at CIBL in Abbotsford, BC, at our University of the Fraser Valley Studios. And we're your hosts, Sonia
and Glenn, and in this episode...
They can't continue killing our black men and getting away with it, black women and getting away with it.
Told they have about 15 minutes to get their stuff out of there, and then the trucks are going to start dumping.
But first, here are the headlines.
Mick Sweetman from The Scope at Ryerson University is reporting to us from the Black Lives Matter rally that took place in Toronto on Monday, July 27th.
We took the streets. We will continue to take the streets.
Yes.
We will continue to fight. We will disrupt lives while we continue to die.
That was Yanea Khan from Black Lives Matter Toronto. She was speaking while blocking the Allen Expressway on Monday, July 27th. Khan was one of a group of activists whose arms were locked to one another, stretching across the major highway in Toronto. Black Lives Matter Toronto was protesting the police shootings of two black men, Andrew Loku, who Toronto police killed in early July, and Jermaine Carby, who was killed by Peel Regional Police in September 2014. On July 21st, Ontario's Special Investigations Unit announced that the officer who shot Carby will not face any charges. In response, Black Lives Matter marched from a parkette near Eglinton and Caledonia, near where Loku was killed, to Allen Road, where they blocked traffic for almost 2 hours.
So the six demands that we've made today,
are
the immediate release of the names of the officers that killed Andrew Loku and Jermaine Carby.
Yes. Woo! Yes.
Charges to be laid against the officers who killed Mr. Loku and Mr. Carby.
Yes. Yes.
A confirmation that the police officers who killed Mr. Loku and Mr. Carby are off the streets.
Yes.
The immediate and public release of any video footage from the apartment complex where Andrew Loku was murdered.
Yes.
A date, no longer than 4 weeks, because no family should have to wait 10 months.
Yes. 10 months. Yes.
When the SIU will get back to Andrew Loku's family and monetary compensation for the family of Andrew Loku and Jermaine Carby.
Sasha Brown's car was about to exit onto Eglinton Avenue when a group of protesters ran onto the road in front of her and stop traffic.
I get what they're saying. I'm 100% on their side, but right now, in this at this area, is not even the case. Like, it's not the right thing to do.
LaTanya Grant is Jermaine Carby's cousin and the founder of Justice for Jermaine Carby. She has been critical about the police account of the shooting and the Ontario Special Investigation Unit's handling of the case.
The officer that killed Jermaine Carby, so let's say Jermaine Carby's murderer, was just let off by the SIU. I call them the secret investigation unit because all they've been doing is keeping secrets from my family. They were not transparent at all. For the fact that a knife was not found on the scene, but then given over to them several hours later, did not have Jermaine's fingerprints on it. This came out of Tony Loparco's mouth himself, but only his DNA makes me question the SIU's integrity.
In a statement released by the Special Investigations Unit, Director Tony Loparco said no knife was found on the scene by the SIU and it was not handed over to investigators until several hours after the incident. Loparco said that an officer's conduct was hard to fathom when he stepped on the knife in Carby's hand and directed towards the curb before picking it up and placing it in a brown paper bag, which he gave to his sergeant. In a scathing statement, Loparco said, quote, "The officer would have known at the time that Mr. Carby likely lay dead or grievously injured as a result of a police shooting." Loparco later says, quote, "As a result of the officer's action, the SIU, and in a broader sense the public, is asked to accept that the knife it retrieved from police was in Mr. Carby's possession when he was shot, and that that same inference could have been more readily and safely been made had the scene not been tampered with." Freelance journalist Desmond Cole, who has been critical of what he says is racism in policing in Toronto, spoke at the rally about the first job he had as a youth worker in downtown Toronto.
The number of young black men who are dealing with the fallout of neglect, abuse, getting kicked out of school, getting kicked out of home, getting taken to jail at a young age. I couldn't believe my eyes when I started to see this. A disproportionate amount of young black men who were struggling. If I know that, our police should know that, and they should act with compassion and with intelligence, with restraint. If I know that, then they have to know that. And the last thing that they should be doing is reaching for a weapon.
As the blockade on Allen Road entered its second hour, the protesters remained defiant.
They can't continue killing our black men and getting away with it, black women and getting away with it. Black lives do matter. We're not animals that can be shot dead in the streets. We'll do this every day if we have to until we get answers.
Around 8 o'clock, a local city TV crew said that Mayor John Tory was live in their studio.
John Tory just said that he would agree to meet with Black Lives Matter Toronto. Yeah!
The blockade ended, but the spirit of Black Lives Matter continues in Toronto. For CJRU The Scope at Ryerson, this is Mick Sweet.
Jennifer Chithart-Tufts of CIVL Radio at the University of the Fraser Valley reports on the current UN rights scrutinization of Canada's treatment of its Aboriginal women.
Over 1,200 missing Aboriginal women nationwide has Canada scrutinized by the UN Human Rights Committee for the first time in a decade. As reported by The Real News, a survey among 112 families that include missing or murdered Native Canadian women says that most were not satisfied with the work or follow-up that police dedicated to the investigation. In some cases, responses were very slow, and in others, communication was not professional or effective. Reports have yielded over 700 recommendations for Canada to implement in order to provide transparency and protection to the families of abducted or murdered women throughout at least 600 reserves and other locales across the country. But Krista Big Canoe of the Aboriginal Legal Services of Toronto says, "We currently in Canada have a government that refuses to listen to the importance of Indigenous lives and deaths, and that Prime Minister Harper has, quote, spent a lot of rhetoric talking about how this is not really an issue of national importance." Krista Big Canoe says this is contradictory to the position advocates take, seeing as First Nations and Indigenous people were the first people here in the country, and historically and systematically have been harmed in a lot of ways. I am Jennifer Trehartafs reporting from CIVL Radio in Abbotsford.
The following headline was written by CKUT's Aaron Lakoff. Six people were arrested in Montreal on July 24th at a demonstration in solidarity with the Unist'ot'en clan in northern British Columbia. Around 30 people took to the downtown streets shortly after 5 p.m. and managed to march for about 15 minutes before Montreal police officers violently pushed people onto the sidewalk. Of the six arrested, one was charged criminally with obstruction, while the others received hefty fines of $500 under a municipal traffic bylaw. All were released within a few hours. The protest was organized to call attention to harassment by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police of Indigenous people at the Unist'ot'en camp near Smithers, B.C. For more than 5 years, the Unist'ot'en clan of the Wet'suwet'en Nation have been blockading their unceded territory to prevent oil and gas companies from encroaching and building seven proposed tar sands and fracked gas pipelines. On July 15th, RCMP officers attempted to enter the blockade but were turned away by Unist'ot'en spokesperson Frida Hooson. The officers returned the following day, but no one was arrested. For more information on the blockade and how to support, visit www.unist'ot'encamp.com. I'm Quinn McIntosh from CIVL Radio, reporting on behalf of CKUT Radio in Montreal.
And that's it for the headlines.
Now it's time for a community radio report from CFRC in Kingston, Ontario.
Here at CFRC, on August 10th, Prisoners Justice Day, we are airing 7 hours of special Prisoners Justice Day dedicated content. We sat down with some of the programmers to talk to them about the importance of Prisoners Justice Day content. You're listening to the Community Radio Report. First, here's programmer and staff person Christiana Clemens talking about our special programming and the history of Prisoners Justice Day.
We have a 7-hour broadcast planned for the day. From 4 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be airing interviews, features, news stories, and memorials about prisoners and prison issues. And then from 8 to 11 p.m., we share messages, music requests, and mail by and for prisoners and their loved ones and supporters. Prisoners Justice Day, although it's an international phenomenon now in its 40th year, was an event that began in the Kingston area at Millhaven Penitentiary in the mid-1970s. There was a gentleman named Eddie Nalin who passed away in his cell in 1974 on August 10th. And on the first anniversary of his death, prisoners at Mill Haven refused to work and fasted as a day of recognizing and remembering Eddie and the really tragic and unjust circumstances of his death, as well as taking time to reflect on unjust and inhumane prison conditions that continue to this day here in North America and around the world.
Now we hear from one of the hosts of Prison Radio, a CFRC show about why it's important for community radio stations to produce Prisoners Justice Day content.
Obviously, most prison radio content, like any activism around prisons, is monitored by corrections, so I choose not to go with my real name. Many people either speaking to us or hosting the show don't use their real names either, but I go with C. Why I think it goes back to just the kind of stations that community and campus radio stations are, is we are rooted in a community in a way that many commercial stations are not, and we are tied in to people in our communities that may be in touch with prisoners, are themselves prisoners, are the families of prisoners, and you know, that is part of our listenership. It's part of the community we're serving. Day-to-day activity of prison, it tends to be people, when they do hear about prison, it's something like someone's death or cuts to it or complaints, or it might be in the more blunt law and order style, in which prisons are just a repository at the end point for the bad guy, quote unquote, when they get sent away. And they're not places, they're not communities in themselves that support, in some cases, thousands of people. And you know, though that often is kind of ignored. So a lot of our programming here at CFRC that deals with prisoners' issues day to day and week to week is just responding to pretty basic human needs, to talk to family, to hear some music that they like, to be able to communicate with somebody who doesn't immediately sneer at the fact that, you know, this is an inmate talking to us or phoning us.
And now for a quick look at what one particular host is doing for their special Prisoners Justice Day episode.
Hi, I am Aline, your host of Speaking Stones, and on Prisoners Justice Day, we will be having an interview with Donnie, James, and David Hogan. Donnie and James are ex-prisoners, and they claim that they were experimented on, and we were just going to explore that issue a little bit. And they're also going to talk about how Queens apparently sponsored the research for the experiment, and it's a really terrible cause, and I really hope you tune in to Speaking Stones at 5:30 p.m. on Monday.
That's all for the Community Radio Report. To listen to CFRC's special Prisoners Justice Day broadcast, you can tune in on Monday, August 10th from 4 until 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time in the Greater Kingston area on 101.9 FM, or you can go to their website and listen to the live stream at cfrc.ca and access the archives past the broadcast date at the same site, cfrc.ca.
Just heard Red Death by Ovillage. Sonia Claus from CIVL reports on the current class action lawsuit the homeless community has against the city of Abbotsford as a result of the Chicken Manure incident that occurred 2 years ago in 2013.
My name is Kevin Miller, and I'm a filmmaker and screenwriter. Well, I actually call the Chicken Manure incident an accidental documentary because I never really set out to make it. I was filming with a guy named Ward Draper, who is the founder of 5 and 2 Ministries, and I was just shooting a profile of him. And when the chicken manure incident happened, I got a phone call from Ward saying that the city had just dumped a bunch of chicken manure on a homeless camp and maybe I'd want to get down there with my camera. And I started filming and just seeing what I could capture and eventually just followed the story all over the place. I was interviewing homeless people in the bushes and under bridges and wherever I could find them, and then going and interviewing the mayor, the police chief, and many other people involved as the story unfolded. Well, I think I reacted the same way most people did, which is with shock and some outrage and just trying to understand how did the best thinking in City Hall lead to basically truckloads of manure dumped on a homeless camp. It didn't seem like the best and brightest had put their heads together on that one. Right. Well, I interviewed a couple of people who were present on the site when it happened, and as they describe in the chicken manure incident, they basically were given, I think, 15 minutes to get their stuff out of the way. And this is, remember, these guys are being prodded awake at 6 in the morning or something, basically being told they have about 15 minutes to get their stuff out of there, and then the trucks are going to start dumping. But again, they weren't, it wasn't like they were sleeping on their own property. They were on private property. They were, you know, knowingly squatting on someone else's land. And so, you know, it's, they weren't necessarily tenants, but let's put it that way. I can't say that I am familiar enough with the particular grounds of the class action suit and basically the element of the Constitution on which they're basing their argument. But I think that one of the difficulties faced by Abbotsford, which is faced by a number of communities on the coast, is in the Lower Mainland, is the fact that people tend to be against building housing that would be appropriate for people who maybe are in the midst of you know, addictive behavior and that sort of thing. But at the same time, then the city makes it illegal to camp on city property. And so if you can't build housing for these people and they can't make a home for themselves somewhere on city property, where are they going to go? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, you end up getting with what I think Ward has called the Abbotsford shuffle, where you the police, they will come and do something like the city did with the chicken manure incident. They'll move people along, and but all they do is set up camp somewhere else, and it just keeps going around and around, and no problem ever really gets solved. And it takes a pretty bold politician to stand up and say we're going to do something about this, because again, politicians are beholden to the people who have the most influence on them getting reelected. And unfortunately, many homeless people and people who are kind of semi-homeless aren't necessarily part of the electoral system, and so they don't really have much of a voice at City Hall, and perhaps politicians feel that they can safely ignore that voice because they're hearing a lot from the property owners and the business owners who are clamoring very loudly for you know, the city to do something about this quote-unquote problem population. So, you know, it takes a bold and a compassionate politician to say, you know what, I'm going to put my own career, my own political career on the line to do what's right instead of what's best for my self-interest. Unfortunately, those types of politicians are few and far between. I need to make it clear that I no longer live in Abbotsford. I moved away close to 2 years ago, but I do kind of keep tabs on the community. I do believe that at least some members of council would like to act, you know, would like to take advantage of these funds. Like, I remember one of the frustrating things at the time of the chicken manure incident is that there was a lot of provincial money on the table to build a low barrier housing on the edge of the downtown core, that the council actually voted against moving forward with that project, which was being advocated by Abbotsford Community Services. So it's quite frustrating for a lot of people involved. So whether things have changed in the last couple of years and that there's been enough of a shuffle on council, or maybe some changes of minds on council, a new mayor, that would make them more open to this, I mean, I guess that remains to be seen.
My name's Faye Bentley, and I'm one of the founders of this camp. We moved here from Jubilee Park in the end of 2013 due to an injunction put out by the city to get us to leave the park because we were in the park, which is not allowed, apparently. We're not looking for compensation, so to speak. I've just found out possibly that city bylaws might end up being changed or amended to allow us to actually erect a structure in parks, in city parks, as long as we take them down in the morning, which is what we're not allowed to do even now, right? We're, the city bylaw states that, like, if it's life or death situation, we can basically hang a tarp or whatever, as long as we take it down in the morning, but we're not allowed to leave it up. But that's like a tarp. It's not, we're not allowed to set up tents or anything, or any type of shelter, so to speak. That's allowed, but it's still not enough, right? So some sort of acknowledgement there that we do need help in that respect. Cause,
just even basic shelter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's the bylaws. It's the bylaws and the fact that we can't live anywhere just because we don't have a home.
The class action suit took place after the chicken manure incident.
It came about because of that initially, I believe, because there was some people that actually lodged complaints against the police that did that, and they got paid out, like they got compensated for that or whatever. But in the end, it's still against the Human Rights Charter. So that is what sparked the whole initial thing. And Barry having the resources to actually start something for us to do, because we don't, a lot of us don't have that. I guess also because the injunction in the park to remove us was, it's the city of Abbotsford versus Barry Shantz, AL. Us, all of us being the AL. So.
Do you think you have enough allies here in the city to support you and your protest?
Oh yeah. Yeah, we're doing really good.
And that was Kevin Miller and Faye Bentley.
That was Bodie, California by Western Jaguar.
In this next feature, CJSF producers Frida Worden and Megan Thomas from Brno BBC, along with Bianca Migliaretto from Switzerland, have provided a report on the Walking With Our Sisters event that took place on BC Day Long Weekend in Vancouver. I'm looking for my sister.
Where did she go? Where did she go? Why? There's a crisis of missing and murdered Indigenous women in this country that has become a national tragedy.
There needs to be a shift in how people think of Indigenous women. We are powerful, and yet we've been oppressed for so many years. And this missing and murdered women is a reflection of how we have been oppressed. And this is something that needs to change in the Indigenous and the non-Indigenous communities.
We're coming to you live from the Comox Band Hall, and we are smack in the middle of a memorial installation. It's called Walking With Our Sisters with Tracy Bear. And now I want to talk about the vamps. A lot of us don't know what vamps are. Mm. What are vamps and what do they symbolize?
A vamp is the top part of a moccasin, which is footwear for many Indigenous people. It's the decorated part of it. When Christy Belcourt had her idea, she thought about walking with our sisters and how the unfinished moccasin would represent the unfinished lives of our missing and murdered women. And so she said, I'm going to make these 600 pairs to represent the then 600 missing and murdered. And then she started making them, and she thought, I can't do 600 pairs. So they did a larger call out, made a deadline, and as that deadline hit closer, they were nowhere near 600. So she's like, everyone, all my friends, we need to get together. Well, little did she know, everyone in this earth is procrastinators, and 1 month before the deadline, she was overwhelmed with over 1,500 pairs of vamps. It has grown to about 1,900 pairs now, and they come from all over North America primarily, but they are from Europe, Australia, New Zealand as well. And they are made of all different materials. You'll see there's fish scale ones, there is soapstone ones, there's your traditional beadwork, quill work.
I saw a seal skin vamp.
All of these vamps are representing loved ones, and people are expressing themselves through art. Oftentimes we feel helpless when we lose someone, and so this was a way for people to express their grief and honor the missing and murdered.
Also, a new addition to the vamps are the children's vamps, the little ones, everything from a little baby to like a toddler. Can you explain to us what the significance of the children's vamp is?
The children's vamps are smaller, and they represent the children who went to residential school and did not return home.
We don't want the young men to feel lost as if they don't have a role in our communities, because their traditional role was that of protector. You know, they were the ones who protected the spirit of the women. That was their job. And we need to, like, reinstate that. We need to, like, stop the cycle of abuse and start to strengthen our young boys so that they can learn to be respectful and the protectors of the female spirit.
How do grandparents and aunties and uncles fit into this picture of keeping our children safe and preventing sexual exploitation and human trafficking?
I think it's not just relatives. I think that every community member should treat all kids as if they are their kids. That is the village mentality. There is not my kid and you deal with your kid and I'll deal with my kid. No, as a village, everyone knows that your investment in any child is an investment in the community. And that really needs to be the shift in thinking. So we're not having this very secular, divided community where you deal with your problems and I'll deal with mine. We need to work as a community to actually help everybody.
And one of the most important teachings that I have got with being on the National Collective is understanding that everywhere we go, there's a community that is thriving and coming together collaboratively. And it's such a beautiful thing to watch as people come together through ceremony, through the songs and dance, through eating. They come together and they build this community even before we get there. And so when we are installing this type of art memorial, you'll see strangers that have just met and they're laughing and they're crying and they're working really hard. So one of the most beautiful things that comes from this, because it is a memorial for our missing and murdered Indigenous sisters and mothers. And we can't forget that, but what we need to see is the community that it offers. And the good of this, besides awareness, is bringing people together and making those relationships stronger so that we can solve this incredible social issue that we have today.
We're at the Walking With Our Sisters Memorial Installation. It's happening from July 31st to August 2015. It's located at 3320 Comox Road in Courtenay, BC. And it's free. Everybody is welcome. Men, women, and children of all different races, come take a walk and honor our sisters. For further information, you can check out www.wwoscomoxvalley.com or www.walkingwithoursisters.
We don't know.
That's it for this edition of Groundwire, produced by CIBL Radio in Abbotsford from the University of the Fraser Valley. Music this week was by O Village and Western Jaguar. Headlines this week were written by Aaron Lacoff and Aaron Levy. We also want to thank Adam Midbenhammer, Carly Forbes, and Groundwire's new national coordination team, Omi Salma Rahantula, Matt Willish, and Ali Dutroot.
Contributors for this edition's features were Sonia Klotz, Frida Worden, Megan Thomas, and Bianca Miglioretto.
Tune in again to hear Groundwire on your local community radio station or download at groundwire.ncra.ca.